Now let's get on with the show. Today's subject is something that started off as almost a snark, almost a pejorative lawfare. We've seen in the course of the last few decades to the point in 2011 where JAGs, lawyers, the law, not just on each serial but ROE, but on everything we do, it's impacting the political, the strategic, the operational, and the tactical level, arguably more than we've seen in many years, or if ever. You know, why do we find ourselves here? Why do we do this? And what direction is all this habit that we're building year after year, what direction is that heading to us when it comes to military operations? We've seen it discussions for what recently happened in Pakistan with Osama bin Laden, but also those that have served in Afghanistan, Iraq, or have been following what's been going on in Libya. They're constantly seeing this reference and how the borders are being drawn and actions are being defined from UN Security Council resolutions all the way down to that strategic corporal that's kicking in a door. And discuss the influence of law is David Glazer. He is commander, United States Navy retired, which we'll get to here in a second. He's a professor of law at Loyola Law School in Los Angeles. Prior to Loyola, he was a lecturer at the University of Virginia Law School and a research fellow at the Center for National Security Law, where he conducted research on national security, military justice, and the law of war. He also served as a pro bono consultant to Human Rights First. And what's great about having Dave on MidRats today is Dave doesn't come to law and its interaction with armed conflict from a theoretical or from an academic standpoint. He's not a retired JAG Corps commander. He's a retired law line officer, a SWO, a frigate man. And he comes to this discussion with that particular background and that perspective, given a little more depth, perhaps, than other people who are looking at it from a different angle. Now let's get on to the show. Dave, welcome to MidRats.
Thank you very much. It's an honor to be here.
Appreciate it a lot. And my opening question, I kind of touched on a little bit there in the intro, is that in the U.S., but really throughout the West and with our allies, JAGs and lawyers, they find themselves everywhere from when you make a strike to make sure that's a good strike, that you can go forward with that, with this aircraft in this location, with this information, and obviously all the way up to levels that people were used to thinking about it, the strategic and the political. And the perception is that it's grown incredibly, especially over the last 10 years. Is that perception accurate? And if it is, why have we gotten here? And where do you see that direction headed to in the future?
Well, it's a good thing the show's an hour long, because that is a question that's probably worthy of a book. And I think the answer really is multi-part. First of all, I think it's worth noting that the idea that law plays an important role in warfare is something new, is a theme that's been developed and talked about a lot in the past couple of years, but I think it's historically inaccurate. Throughout the history of the United States, law has been given very serious attention in the conduct of our military operations. George Washington, you might say, if we're looking for someone who invented the idea of lawfare, meaning the importance of law as a tool to be used to military advantage during time of war, George Washington is really the originator of that idea, who recognized that fighting the British at a time when, first of all, he couldn't rely on the support even of a majority of the people in the American colonies. I mean, I think the historical evidence suggests generally about one-third of the Americans were in favor of fighting for independence, about one-third were loyal to the king, and about a third were simply trying to eke out an existence in the American wilderness and didn't really care one way or the other. So he recognized that for the U.S. to be perceived, the American side as being perceived as conducting their military operations in a way that was consistent with law was important to trying to maximize the public support on this continent, as well as important to trying to persuade folks in Europe that they ought to be, you know, leaning towards the colonists and newly declared independent states over Great Britain. And it really, I think, hit its peak during the Mexican-American War, when General Winfield Scott recognized that taking an army down to Mexico, which never numbered more than 20,000, and during most of his operations he had more like 10,000 troops available, confronting an enemy army that was at least three times that size and a hostile, potentially hostile population of more than 7 million, that it was really important that the Americans be perceived as caring and respectful. And so he actually contributed to the development of much of the modern law of war in restrictions that he unilaterally placed on his troops in order to try to win the hearts and minds of the Mexicans. So the first part of the answer is that this is not entirely something new. Now, why does it have so much visibility today? Well, I think one thing, and this is where my background as a warrior comes into play. As I have looked back, you know, at the history of these earlier American conflicts, the law of war was really core professional knowledge of the warrior. They didn't need lawyers because the warriors, particularly the professional West Point trained officers in the Army, had internalized this knowledge and were able to apply the rules directly. The most famous early development in the law of war was something called the Lieber Code that was written by a Columbia University professor, Francis Lieber, in 1863, and then promulgated to the Union Army as General Orders 100. Well, the reason that the Army Commanding General, Henry Halleck, wanted this code developed and presented was because of this huge influx during the Civil War of civilians into the military. You had a lot of influential folks given direct commissions as colonels or even as general officers with no military background whatsoever. And these folks were just making a legal mess of both the conduct of the war as well as military trials, court-martials, and military commissions because they just didn't have the professional knowledge that was assumed to be inherent in part of being a military officer. And so the idea of the Lieber Code was to give these guys a document that was manageable in size that they could be expected to sort of carry around with them and read and start to get it right. Now, today we have a highly trained professional military, but it seems to me that one of the ironies of the way the military has developed in the post-World War II era is that we now have these very large professional judge advocate corps. You know, each service has somewhere typically between 700 and 1,000 lawyers in uniform on active duty. The Marines have a smaller number, obviously. But they have sort of institutionally taken over responsibility for the law of war. I think it sort of makes sense in terms of organizational theory and bureaucratic politics. You know, they sort of enhance their importance to the commander by being an advisor, not just on traditional legal things, but also, and it makes them feel like they're warriors now because they get to participate in these targeting discussions and stuff. But the irony is that for anyone who has been involved in targeting, for example, you know that it's not really just a matter of law. It's very much a matter of the interface between law and facts. So when you're making targeting decisions, you don't just talk about the law, but you have to talk about the strategic or tactical value of the target involved. You have to talk about the technical aspects of the weapon system. You have to talk about the choices of potential one weapon versus another. You know, do I want to use a 500-pound bomb? Do I want to use a 500-pound bomb with a laser seeker on it? Do I want to use a bomb with a GPS seeker? Do I want to use a Hellfire missile? Do I want to send SEAL team in to do this? So very, very much requires a great deal of specific technical and tactical knowledge. So one of the things that I find it sort of ironic, not necessarily in a good way, is that, you know, we essentially you have to make a decision. Do I want to give the lawyers the technical knowledge to contribute to the decision process, or do I want to give the commanders and military planners the legal knowledge that they need to go with the tactical knowledge that they already have? And it seems like we sort of institutionally have decided to go in the direction of trying to give the JAGs the tactical knowledge so that they can participate in these decision processes, rather than go back to the expectation that the warriors will have the legal knowledge. And I think that has potentially been a mistake, particularly because so many of our operations and so many of the situations that we have seen that are being, you know, advertised as war crimes happen away from headquarters. They happen out in the field, where there's a patrol, where the senior individual on the scene is an NCO or a very junior officer. And they're several echelons away from the nearest lawyer. And so concentrating this professional knowledge of the law of war in the hands of the lawyers, I think, I personally believe, has really not served us well at all.
Well, that raises a huge number of questions, but I want to go back to a law review article you wrote in 2000. I don't know when you wrote it, but it was published in William & Mary Law Review in 2009. And the article was titled "Playing by the Rules, Combating Al-Qaeda Within the Law of War." And one of the things that struck me in that article you wrote was how important definitions are. As you worked your way through the various conventions and the law of war that you cited in there, a lot of times the decision that you would make as to how to treat an Al-Qaeda, a captive Al-Qaeda member, it depends on how he is defined. And I think you were discussing, I'm jumping way ahead of where we should be in terms of building the blocks to discuss this. But one of the questions is, when we take somebody, an Al-Qaeda captive, and we put him into permanent, semi-permanent detention, what is the law of war that pertains to that? Is he covered by the Geneva Convention? He's not in. And the reasons he may or may not be, could you kind of go through the thought process of how we should treat some of these people and why it's important that where the law of war might cover it, where we should apply it, and where the holes exist, what we should do in those cases?
Okay, well, I think, if you don't mind, I'm going to use that question as sort of the grounds to sort of move a little bit further forward from my first answer, because I think it really is sort of a perfect example of, again, why this legal stuff has become so important here. Because one of the unique aspects of the conflict that we've been engaged in for the last 10 years is that it does not fit neatly into the existing international law. Since, I think it's very safe to say that since 1949, which essentially, you know, now we're talking over a half century, the Geneva Conventions, which were four enacted in 1949, and since then they've become essentially universally ratified. There are 194 countries which are formally parties to the Geneva Conventions. There are only 192 member states in the United Nations. So the UN Convention, the UN Charter, is only the second, essentially, most ratified treaty or set of treaties in the world. The Geneva Conventions are actually the most ratified treaties in the world. And so everybody who's dealt with the law of war has sort of become very much focused on the Geneva Convention since 1949. Now, they divide armed conflict into two basic categories. There is an international armed conflict, which is defined by what's called Common Article 2. Each of the four conventions has the same wording, exact wording, as its Article 1, as its Article 2, and as its Article 3. And so those articles are called Common Article 1, 2, and 3. So Common Article 2, which isn't talked about that much, but it sets forth the conflicts to which the conventions apply. And it says they apply to an international armed conflict, which is defined as a conflict between two or more states that are parties to the Geneva Conventions. Now, when the Geneva Conventions apply to a conflict, the answers are pretty straightforward. You have a set of people defined in the third Geneva Convention, which covers prisoners of war, and that's really the one that everybody knows about. And when you see a reference on a television show or in a movie to the Geneva Conventions, almost invariably they don't really mean conventions plural. They just mean the third Geneva Convention dealing with prisoners of war. So if someone qualifies as a prisoner of war, which basically means they're a member of an organized military group that's sponsored by a state, then the rules for, you know, for how they're to be treated are very, very straightforward, and they're spelled out in the convention. Now, if someone doesn't qualify as a prisoner of war, then they're logically a civilian, and the Fourth Geneva Convention, which deals with the protection of civilians, has very clear rules for how they're to be treated. And you can detain a civilian, even someone who's picked up arms against you. You can detain them for security purposes, but unlike the prisoner of war, they have to be subject to periodic review. Their detention is supposed to be reviewed by an administrative or judicial process every 6 months. But there are very clear rules, you know, for how they're to be treated, too. The problem is that, you know, we're not fighting a traditional international armed conflict. Now, Common Article 3 defines non-international armed conflict, but it defines that as a traditional, essentially, civil war insurrection. It's defined as a conflict taking place in the territory of a single state, which is party to the Geneva Conventions. Well, we don't have either of those, right? We don't have when we're fighting Al-Qaeda, we don't have a traditional international armed conflict because Al-Qaeda is not a nation state and hasn't joined the Geneva Conventions. In fact, it can't join the Geneva Conventions. On the other hand, we don't really have a non-international armed conflict either because we're not fighting Al-Qaeda within the United States. You know, Al-Qaeda is not the Confederacy. They are overseas, and they're individuals who are not, by and large, U.S. citizens, don't owe the U.S. any duty of loyalty, and the conflict is not taking place in our territory. And so the rules that virtually everyone is familiar with, inside the military and out, that tell you how you have to treat people that you're detained, don't, you know, really seem to apply here. What we really have is a transnational armed conflict, and that it transcends national boundaries and transcends any nationality in terms of citizenship, but doesn't fit cleanly within these rules. And this is one of the reasons also, I think, why, you know, lawyers have been so visible because of the challenge in wrestling with this. And when the conflict broke out in 2001, you know, my sense really is that the military lawyers really didn't know what to do. All they had been trained in, really, was the Geneva Conventions. And the administration, on the other hand, had some lawyers who had a very clear sense of what they wanted to do. And what they wanted to do was they wanted to maximize the flexibility of the United States to deal with these organizations as the president saw fit. And so they were very consciously trying to argue against the mandatory application of any body of law. And so that left essentially this huge, you know, legal gap, and the administration was not interested in having its best and brightest lawyers figure out a rational legal scheme for dealing with detainees. It wanted the flexibility to treat them outside of any recognized scheme. Now, my personal sense is that, you know, this is sort of where law of knowledge or law of war expertise really sort of is important, because, okay, we're outside the treaty regimes, we're outside the scope of coverage of the Geneva Conventions. That doesn't mean that we're outside the law. The reality is that there's long-standing, you know, centuries of development of customary international law rules, and we could have looked at those. We also, I think, you know, had some choice. I mean, first of all, we had no obligation to treat the situation with Al-Qaeda as an armed conflict at all. We had every right, including the support of a number of international treaties and long history, to simply say these guys are nothing more than common criminals. And now, you know, the rational person looks at this and says, well, geez, you know, Al-Qaeda has these large training camps in Afghanistan. They have hundreds, if not thousands, of fighters. we're not going to send, you know, you're smoking illegal stuff if you think we're just going to send the FBI or U.S. Marshals over there with arrest warrants, and they're going to arrest these guys. But there was an intermediate option, which was basically the piracy paradigm, because pirates have always been treated as criminals, but yet they're also recognized as criminals whose essentially military-like capabilities are too powerful to deal with normal law enforcement. And so the piracy paradigm has really been one of using military force to combat and apprehend the pirates, but then they're treated as ordinary criminals once they're rounded up. So, you know, it seemed to me that we sort of had three choices. Number one, we could treat the folks from Al-Qaeda as simply ordinary criminals and apply ordinary law enforcement. Number two, we could treat them as the functional equivalents of pirates, that is, criminals, but criminals who are too remote and too powerful to be dealt with by ordinary law enforcement, and therefore we would essentially use the military to go out, combat them, but once they were rounded up, we would put them in the criminal law paradigm. Or the third option was to say, look, this really is an armed conflict. We're going to treat this as an armed conflict, and we want to use essentially sort of detention authority from the law of armed conflict to deal with these folks once the military has capture them and they've come into our custody. And then I think what we needed to do, if we cared about the law, was to look in good faith essentially to customary international law rules and say, okay, it's true that this factual situation falls outside the scope of conflict as defined in the Geneva Conventions, but that doesn't mean it falls outside of law entirely. It just means that we need to dig a little bit deeper and essentially call upon some little bit greater expertise than folks who've simply read the Geneva Conventions and the U.S. military manual based on the Geneva Conventions and look to sort of the customary law rules. And the reality is that the results are not really very different, but you do actually then avoid some of what Alberto Gonzalez famously called the quaint aspects of the Geneva Convention. For example, the Geneva Convention requires that detainees be paid a notional salary, and if you don't know what the salary is, then a private soldier, for example, has to get 8 French francs per month. And while I disagree with a number of things that Alberto Gonzalez has said, I think it's safe to say that the American public would have been sort of irritated, you know, if we were paying Al-Qaeda detainees 8 French francs a month. So there are, in fact, some provisions in the Geneva Conventions that would seem quaint in a conflict against a group like Al-Qaeda.
In the first half of the decade that we've been engaged in this, what I still call the long war, for lack of a better phrase, a phrase that was talked about a lot was unlawful combatant. And a lot of people had the instinct, well, they're unlawful combatants, they're lucky they're alive, they can be, you know, summarily executed on the field. But here we find ourselves, these people we have captured, they're down in the Caribbean having a library card and access to an Xbox if they behave themselves. What is the correct definition of an unlawful combatant? And is anybody in this war right now really meet that definition and being treated as such?
Well, that's an excellent question, and one that there isn't necessarily universal agreement on. But to be a lawful combatant, the rules seem pretty clear. That you have to be sort of part of a military organization. You have to have some sort of command structure where someone is legally responsible for your conduct and behavior. And that, by the way, is the real problem, it seems to me, with the CIA participation in these hostilities, in that the CIA does not have a legal command structure. You cannot court-martial a CIA supervisor because one of his subordinates violated the law of war in the way that a military officer or NCO is actually legally accountable for the behavior of subordinates. That is a formal requirement of the law of war. So you have to have a distinctive emblem, and your organization is supposed to try to enforce compliance with the law of war. So if you meet those criteria, you are a legal or lawful combatant. Now, what the law of war does for the lawful combatant is that it immunizes them from prosecution under domestic law. Now, what do I mean by that? Well, you know, what do we expect combatants to do in wartime? We expect them to basically kill people, and we expect them to destroy property. And every nation on earth has laws that make it a crime to kill, except in very, very narrow circumstances of self-defense, and to destroy property. And so simply by going to war and doing what your government calls upon you to do, you would be a criminal under the domestic law of any state that you were sent off to engage in hostilities in. And so the law of war says that if you are a lawful combatant, you cannot be judged under the domestic laws of the countries where you engage in armed conflict for the military activities that you perform. You can only be judged against the law of war. If you are not a lawful combatant, for example, you don't wear a uniform, you're not part of an organization that adheres to the law of war, then what the rules basically say is you don't get that domestic immunity. And so you can be tried for any act of violence that you commit. This is one of the oddities right now of sort of the military commission process down at Guantanamo. Because if these folks are unlawful combatants, there's no reason to judge them or try them under the law of war. They ought to be tried under ordinary domestic law for common crimes. If they've killed someone, they're murderers. If they've blown up property, then they are vandals and destructors of property. Now, I think the customary rules and as well as the Geneva Conventions would still permit their indefinite detention as long as they remain a threat, but they ought to be tried. Now, the idea that an unlawful combatant is some sort of evil person who can just be lined up against the wall and shot, that is something that the United States has never really accepted, although it's mentioned and hinted at in sort of the Lieber Code. But the United States has always insisted on providing a trial. And in any event, it is indisputable that since at least the end of the 1800s, that international law has also formally required a trial. So if people don't like the fact that detainees at Guantanamo are being treated a little bit better, say, than inmates in our federal courts, then all we have to do is put them on trial and convict them. The point is that international law says that when you preventively detain someone, that you're detaining someone simply because they pose a threat to you, and if released, we think these folks would go out and rejoin the fight without having tried and convicted them of anything, then yeah, the law does require a great deal of humanity. And we've all seen the prisoner of war camp movies from World War II, where they're living in barracks that look very much like the barracks that American soldiers lived in World War II. And they've got libraries, and they play soccer, and they play chess and cards and stuff, because they're being preventively detained. They're not being punished. When a prisoner of war committed an offense, then they went to the cooler for 30 days, and then they were actually in a jail cell. But they were, because they were being disciplined for a specific offense. So if we don't like the fact that Al-Qaeda folks are living in conditions in Guantanamo that we think are just too nice for folks who are terrorists, then the unlawful part of their combatancy allows us to try them under ordinary criminal law for their conduct, and that's what we ought to do. And then once we've done that, we can lock them away in a federal penitentiary under much harsher conditions, and the international community would have absolutely no issue with that.
Well, it does raise sort of an odd question about whether they're afforded, if we were to try them in our normal criminal courts and give them the protections of our normal criminal law, which protections may differ greatly from the protections that other countries might offer people in their circumstance. Isn't there sort of an odd systemic hole there that they actually, because of their capture, say, on a battlefield, we didn't collect forensic evidence that says this guy pulled the trigger and shot Corporal Jones or whatever. How do we deal with that? I mean, it seems like a very awkward way to go, even though it might be technically the right thing to do. We really haven't gathered evidence on the field of combat like we would in a criminal investigation.
Well, you know, that certainly is portrayed as one of the difficulties, but the irony is that the military commissions still have the proof beyond a reasonable doubt standard. And so, you know, the reality is that if we can't convict someone in a federal court, we actually can't convict them before a military commission either. The only potential difference right now between the military commissions and the federal courts is just really the issue of hearsay, at least the only legitimate difference, because the reality is that there still has to be evidence of the fact that they committed an actual crime in order to convict them at Guantanamo. And the reality is that federal offenses are actually more robust than the law of war offenses available to the military commissions are. So, for example, providing material support to terrorism, it has been tried at Guantanamo, but it's up for appeal right now before the first level military court. And every law of war expert and every American legal scholar that I know that has credibly looked at the issue has come to the conclusion that it does not state a violation of the law of war. And given that the jurisdiction for the Guantanamo Military Commissions is based on the law of war, the reality is that those convictions should, in fact, be overturned, whereas it's perfectly legitimate to prosecute someone for the federal offense of providing material support to terrorism in a federal court. And the same is true of conspiracy. War crimes tribunals at the end of World War II, including American courts, specifically looked at the issue of conspiracy and specifically said, you know, this is not a war crime. And they threw out charges based on conspiracy. And yet that's something we've tried to prosecute folks at Guantanamo. So it's interesting, you know, there's a real argument about where the greatest risk of failure is. And a lot of people assume that the standards provided in federal court create a greater risk of failure there, but having studied the military commission process extensively, as well as the historical development of the law in this area, I think there is much greater risk of failure in the military commission process than the federal courts. The two courts now use the same rules for handling classified information, and you know, a lot of people have. I mean, you raised a very fair question about what if it, you know, they just were not collecting evidence on the battlefield. But one of the questions a lot of people think is, well, the Fourth Amendment, you know, certainly soldiers in the battlefield are not aware of the constitutional law rules involved and don't have a chance to get search warrants and stuff. But that doesn't matter. The Supreme Court held a number of years ago in a decision by Chief Justice Rehnquist that the Fourth Amendment doesn't apply outside of the United States, even with respect to federal courts. And the interesting thing was his decision was brilliantly foresighted. He specifically anticipated the possibility that someone would be brought to the federal courts after having been captured by the military abroad and recognized that the military would not follow standard evidence collection procedures. And he wrote a decision that cleared the way for those individuals to still be tried in the federal courts. And this is before 9/11, so it was just, you know, brilliant foresight.
Dave, another question, and just for people who have joined us late, our guest today is David Glazier, professor of law at Loyola Law School in Los Angeles. I want to kind of take the last couple of questions and turn the mirror back on us. It's kind of a point of personal interest to me because about 18 months ago I had some interesting job opportunities I decided to turn down. But you wrote an article a while back discussing the legal aspects of the CIA drone pilots, or UAS or UAV pilots, depending upon who you're talking to. But there's also a very large segment of civilian contractors engaged in this law, whether you're talking about civilians who are flying, doing intelligence, or managing drone operations in the globally in this long war, or you're talking about the civilians in Afghanistan who are part of provisional or district reconstruction teams. Where do they stand inside of the law, and has this huge use of non-military people and quasi-military roles in Iraq and Afghanistan, has that opened up a new area of law that people need to be aware of or that there needs to be work done on?
Well, this is an interesting, a very interesting question. Now, the first thing, this is another one of those areas, ironically, where you know, people who are sort of commenting and writing about these issues seem, in many cases, to really be unaware of our history. The extensive use of civilians in supporting military functions is new from a 20th century perspective, but not new from an American historical perspective. So during the, from the Revolution up through at least the American Civil War, for example, there tended to be extensive use of civilians in the vicinity of the battlefield and in military camps. So, for example, a lot of the supply functions for our troops during the Revolution and afterwards were tended to be performed by civilians. It used to be that the artillery and wagons were always driven by civilian teamsters. So you actually had civilians on the battlefield positioning the artillery pieces, and then only the actual gunners, you know, the guys that actually loaded and fired the cannons would actually be military.
You know, that's an interesting point, because my wife has an ancestor who got a military pension because he was a civilian teamster that took supplies during the Revolution. But anyway, continue. That's a good point.
One thing that really surprised me during the Mexican War, now this is, you know, because you guys are from a military background, and you know how in today's military, you know, we very much have a can-do spirit, right? And we don't play union games, and you know, the command needs something done. Somebody steps forward and does it. And, you know, and very rarely does somebody say, hey, that's not my job description. You know, people just pitch in and get the job done. Well, at the end of the Mexican War, the U.S. forces are in Mexico City, 150 or so miles from the coast, and, you know, they have the same problems that we're, you know, reading about today in Iraq, for example, need to move all this equipment out of the country and stuff. Well, they have all these wagons of supplies that they need to get down to the coast, and they don't have enough teamsters to drive them. Now, you know, today we would say, you know, well, we would just canvass our sailors or soldiers or Marines and say, hey, look, any of you guys, you know, grown up on a farm, anybody know how to drive a wagon? Okay, you know, Private so-and-so, Corporal so-and-so, you drive this wagon, you drive this wagon. Well, then they didn't think they could do that. And so the commanders actually offered immediate discharges to anybody who would agree to accept a discharge in Mexico City, you know, 150 miles in enemy territory, and accept an immediate position as a teamster so that they could drive the wagons or the artillery pieces down to the coast. So the pervasiveness and this clear sense of some of these things are simply civilian functions and we don't do them is not something new. Now, the law of war does address this. So, for example, you look at the Third Geneva Convention, which I mentioned discusses prisoners of war. Article 4 of the Third Geneva Convention describes eligibility to be a prisoner of war. In addition to the requirements for combatants that we already talked about, it actually talks about civilian supporting personnel. So if a contractor accompanying the military is captured in a theater of operations, then even though they're a civilian and not military, the law actually anticipates this and provides that they too can be detained as a prisoner of war for the duration of hostilities. To my thinking, what makes the current situation and this current use of contractors unique, though, is sort of the blurring of combatant and non-combatant responsibilities. So there's really no legal issue if, you know, the contractors are servicing military equipment, if they're cooking food for the military, if they're doing laundry, you know, and cutting their hair. Even if they're, you know, they're driving ammunition trucks up to the front lines or something, the law, you know, is quite capable of dealing all that. But it does seem like we're certainly seeing, and we saw like in Iraq with the famous Nisour Square incident where Blackwater were being used as armed guards, and that we're starting to blur the distinction between combatant and non-combatant roles of the contractors. That does become an issue. And it particularly becomes an issue for the United States because at Guantanamo, in the military commissions, we're essentially asserting, and frankly, virtually all law of war scholars think the U.S. is wrong on this point, but we're essentially asserting that these unlawful combatants, in other words, these enemy folks who don't have uniforms and aren't part of a formal command structure, commit a crime, a war crime, simply by participating in hostilities. And it is odd, right, and really inconsistent of the United States government, on the one hand, to be prosecuting folks at Guantanamo for being what are essentially unlawful combatants participating in hostilities, and then turn around and use American civilians to essentially do the same thing in Afghanistan. Now, under the U.S. theory, legal theories at Guantanamo, these folks commit a war crime by doing that. Now, the good news is that I think it's the U.S. legal theories that are wrong, and that these folks don't commit war crimes. But on the other hand, they don't have any immunity for domestic law. So if a CIA, you know, operative in Afghanistan or Pakistan should kill someone, or a defense contractor, you know, goes along on a convoy and ends up, you know, and has a rifle, and the convoy is attacked, and they end up, you know, fighting, there's a very real legal risk, although, you know, as a practical matter, let's face it, the chances of prosecution may be low. But as a matter of law, they have no right to participate in hostilities, and they are, in fact, liable to prosecution under local law for any acts of violence that they participate in.
Let me check here for a second.
Hey, Eagle One, it... Okay, Eagle One, looks like you fell down the well. Let me, if you want to, go ahead and disconnect and reconnect. Sorry about that, Dave. That happens now and then to either Eagle One or myself. Let me ask you kind of a question totally out of left field here. Is, you know, when I introduced your background, that you were a line officer, retired, and then went to law school and went forward. When you look at your time there as a service warfare officer, and I wanted to bring up an observation I always had during my career, is that I had to deal with a JAG, usually not in the first person, but I always enjoyed when I had to sit across a table from a JAG who was a JO line officer, usually service warfare. Occasionally you get an aviator as well. Then went through the naval on the Navy side, he had the legal education program, went to law school, came back as a JAG, as opposed to a JAG who came fresh out of law school with no military background, especially the real junior ones. When you look back at that perspective and you look at how the Navy brings its JAGs up, would you adjust any how we educate or bring JAGs into the Navy, or do you think the way that we do it right now works pretty well?
No, that's a good question, and you know, I certainly worked with a lot of JAGs during my career, and most were quite good. A few were exceptional, and then I dealt with a few who were kind of embarrassing, quite frankly. But here is, you know, sort of my perspective, both from the surface warfare days, as well as being sort of a law professor and looking at the outside of sort of the service selection process. Because, you know, one of the things I do find on my campus, being essentially the only member of my legal faculty that has any significant military experience, one of the things I'm pleased to be able to do is talk to students who think they're interested in the military. And sort of talk to them about the pros and cons of military service, as well as the differences between the services, because there are very different experiences in terms of the JAGs. But I do think that the very best JAGs that I worked with, by and large, particularly sort of the mid-level ones, by and large, the ones that in fact had a warfare device, were much better. Now, in part, it's the fact that they have sort of seen things from the other side of the fence and that they have been warriors, too. But in part, it's also very much the competitiveness of the selection. because to get a fully funded legal education, you know, paid for by the military, because the way that the services do it is that each service does in fact select a few of its junior officers to go spend 3 years going to law school. They're still on active duty. They're drawing full pay and allowances. They're amassing credit towards retirement, and they're getting their full tuition paid. So it really is a tremendous opportunity. And as a result, it is extremely competitive. And so to have that, you know, and it's based primarily a little bit on their academic background, but it's also based on their dedicated performance, you know, as a junior officer. So they have to be absolute true front runners to get that. So it's not surprising that they become very, very good lawyers, because these are simply very, very bright, motivated, hardworking folks who are going to be successful at whatever they do. Now, from the civilian perspective, the reality is that unlike military medicine, which will pay for individuals to get a medical degree, the JAG Corps generally does not subsidize the education. And so folks basically have to pay their own way through law school, which today generally involves incurring a fair amount of debt, and then have to decide that they want to be, you know, military lawyers. Now, you know, the good news is that the number of individuals who are very talented decide as a matter of, you know, of patriotism, this is something that they really want to do. But you also have a number of people who are sort of leaning towards this because they don't have offers from high-paying law firms. And so the reality is, I think, you know, that overall, there's a pretty fair number of folks who, you know, sort of entering military law because they don't have great alternatives on the outside. So I have always found that the folks that have the military background competed against other warriors for the right to get a funded legal education are definitely, you know, very, very impressive individuals. Now, as a practical matter, so, I mean, I would, one thing that, that if we, you know, if you're looking for sort of an immediate way to improve the quality of lawyers in the military, the first obvious thing then, I think, is to select more of these folks from within the service, not just because, I mean, in part they have greater maturity, they have, and they will bring the experience of being a leader, even as a junior officer, you know, at least they've been division officers and had to lead people and work with our soldiers, sailors, airmen, Marines, and that is worth quite a bit, I think. But it's also a way to get sort of, you know, higher caliber folks more quickly. The other real problem with the military is we've all of us have been in the military are familiar with the sort of some of the costs of the up and out promotion system. And one of the things it does is it, you know, it rewards generalists. We generally look as we're promoting people to higher rank for people that have a broad range of experience. And the JAG Corps definitely falls prey to this. So if you want to get promoted in the JAG Corps, you've got to have had experience in criminal law. You've got to have done, you know, court-martial practice. But you also have to have experience as a manager. You have to have experience in other areas of law. The Navy, for example, does a lot of environmental law. There are lots of different legal areas. And so basically it rewards knowing a little bit about everything, which means you don't, you know, a lot about nothing. And it really acts as an actual bar to the development of any real corporate expertise in an area like the law of war, which really takes years of study in order to master. I deal a lot, for example, with the Army's Judge Advocate School because it's in Charlottesville, co-located with the University of Virginia where I went to law school. And they have an operational law department, which concentrates on the law of war. The folks are there for a three-year tour. They come in there for their first year as a student, and they spend a year studying a wide range of issues. The law of war is just one of the subjects that they study. And then they stay on for 2 years as an instructor. And now suddenly they're the expert in a subject that the previous year they spent part of a year studying. There are a number of Army, really former Army officers who I respect very much as law of war experts, but they all retired as lieutenant colonels because they were not promotable because they didn't have a broad range of experience. And so the current military structure, which rewards people who gather the broadest range of experience and effectively penalizes folks who become real specialists, really precludes military officers from developing the kind of expertise needed in the law of war. And so, you know, I mentioned early on, I think, that the challenges of this unique conflict against Al-Qaeda, which doesn't fit into one of these neat categories, to my thinking, it really, really threw the judge advocates for a total loop, because they weren't experts in the law of war. They were, you know, they had sort of a cursory understanding of the Geneva Conventions. And once presented with a conflict that fell outside the scope of the Geneva Conventions, they're just sort of, you know, scratching their heads saying, what do we do here? And that is very much, you know, it's not an indictment of any individual officers serving in the Judge Advocate Corps, most of whom are very talented and all of whom I think are conscientious and hardworking. It really is a systemic problem where the current structure and promotion system, you know, weighs against this. Now, I know a little bit, just enough to be dangerous, of the fact that the Navy JAG Corps is trying to develop a model that will allow officers to specialize a bit more. My understanding is it's really concentrated in the area of criminal law to sort of allow officers to become more expert practitioners of court-martial practice. But that is at least a step in the right direction, I think.
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay, good. I want to take something you just said and hit you with a question about the humanitarian intervention situation that we have in Libya. You said that the war against Al-Qaeda kind of fell in between the gaps in the knowledge of normal JAG officers. These humanitarian interventions, which look like war to me, but are not fought for the reasons we normally fight war, not for defensive purposes. How does that fit into the law of war? And then the second part of the question is, given the current fight between the president saying that there is no need to do the War Powers Act and I think some contrary opinions in Congress, where does it stand in our own legal system?
Oh, excellent question. International law really that deals with armed conflict is really divided into sort of two independent segments, and there are these fancy Latin terms to describe them. So the first is what's called the jus, and it's spelled, depending on how traditional the writer is, either J-U-S or sometimes they use the I instead of the J-I-U-S, so that's the jus part. Ad, A-D, which is Latin for two, and bellum, which is a form of war. So it's really the law that governs the resort to the use of armed force. And that's really the area of law where these humanitarian interventions, you know, pose these unique questions. We all, you know, sort of know intuitively, or specifically, depending on how much we've studied the issue, that a state has the right to resort to armed force when it's attacked. And the UN Charter, which, you know, is designed essentially to end war, still recognizes very clearly in Article 51 that states have the right to use force when they're attacked. The question is, to what extent does a state have the right to use force when someone else is attacked? Or, more controversial but more common today, what if you're simply trying to intervene in somebody else's business for humanitarian purposes? Now, what we really talk about as the law of war, though, the rules that really govern how the warrior conducts the actual hostilities, is the second branch, which is known as the jus in bello, law in war. And the law, that part of the law, doesn't care how you got to armed conflict. All it cares about is that military force is being applied. And so it's what talks about, you know, the protection of civilians, the fact that you can legally target military objects, but you can't legally target civilians, that doctors and medical personnel aren't objects of attack. And so that's really, these are the body of rules that we're really talking about. And those rules really are unchanged. So once the countries made the decision and the UN Security Council authorized the use of force in Libya, then the conduct of those hostilities should be conducted in accordance with essentially the law of armed conflict. And as a practical reason, you know, it used to be philosophers and lawyers, and here I'm really talking about sort of like the Middle Ages, and maybe the 16 early 1700s, who thought that we ought to make a distinction between whether a country was in the right or in the wrong, and a country that was in the right ought to be able to do more things in the use of force. And the international community realized this is wholly unworkable, because no country ever says, yes, I started this war, but it was unlawful of me to do so. And so scholars, lawyers, statesmen, military officers have all come to agree that the law really does need to separate these branches very, very discreetly, and that once you're in an armed conflict, the rules are the same, regardless of sort of how you got there. And so with respect to the Libya thing, you know, in terms of we're flying airplanes, we're, at least we used to be, right? Supposedly we've turned this over to the Allies. But in terms of what can be attacked, how you would attack it, you know, all those rules should be exactly the same, despite the fact it's billed as a humanitarian intervention. Now, that being said, what about the United States going into an armed conflict? And I think, you know, as sort of a professor who both looks at the law of war and actually coincidentally happens to teach constitutional law, I think that we have to look at there sort of being a two-part test for the legality of U.S. participation in hostilities. The first part is sort of the international law. Does our entering into this conflict comport with international law? And in this case, it seems to me that's satisfied by the U.N. Security Council resolution authorizing nations to become involved. But then the second part is, does it comport with our Constitution, which commits the power to declare war to Congress? And most legal scholars, and I certainly, you know, number myself in this camp, believe that the best reading of that, particularly if you look back at the early historic process, is not that Congress actually has to mechanistically use the words declare war, but that Congress does, in fact, have to be the branch that authorizes the use of force. Now, I think it's well recognized that there are some constitutional exceptions. So if there's an attack on the United States, or an attack on the United States is actually imminent, or Americans have been attacked abroad, that the president is recognized as sort of having an independent authority and even responsibility to begin operations, you know, as necessary to protect Americans and vital interests without waiting for, you know, for action by Congress. And if the situation is a short-lived one, you know, the president acts decisively, rescues the Americans, or comes to the aid of the American military, you know, that was attacked or something, then the reality is there may never be time for Congress to authorize it, particularly if the president can find the money for the operation in existing military appropriations. But Libya doesn't seem to satisfy, you know, that requirement. We were not in Libya to rescue Americans who were being held hostage. You know, we're there intervening as a humanitarian matter to assist the Libyan people. And, well, you know, my personal view is that it is a good thing that we're doing this from a humanitarian perspective. From a constitutional perspective, I do think that Congress has the authority to make the decision as to whether or not this is something we're supposed to do, and that the president is not supposed to engage in that kind of unilateral operation.
Well, Dave, thank you very much for taking time out of your Sunday to spend some time with us here on MedRats. And what's the one big item you think is coming down the road in the next decade in the military aspects of law that people with sharp minds maybe ought to take a look at?
Oh, boy. That's the right question to throw on someone with no surprise. In the overall scheme of the law of war, I think that what we will need to sort of look for or at is whether or not, in fact, there is a decision to sort of treat this transnational armed conflict that I've talked about as something that requires sort of separate recognition and treatment, and whether this is something that the international community, in fact, is interested in sort of developing more specific rules to try to address, or whether people think that, in fact, we should simply sort of ferret out or divine rules from the existing body of law that can be applied to it.
So if somebody wanted to give you full per diem to spend a few months in Geneva, you'd be willing to go there as long as you can take your family and friends, huh?
Absolutely.
Well, thanks again. We appreciate you coming on.
It was a real honor. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you, Dave.
And thanks, everybody, who's listening for Mid-Rats today, and I hope you have a great Navy Day.